as you can see, there's a large blank here where the suggestions are. I didn't send an email around saying add suggestions, but so we'll have to busk a bit. I don't have a massively different plan from the previous supervisions tutorials, so I think that I hope you have, despite having written anything down, you have some sort of questions that we can talk through. We could potentially just look through one of the exercises if there's a completely obvious one that lots of people think is a really good one to work through. But a lot of the exercises are sort of turning the handle rather than massive epiphanies. So if there are any... So I think a higher value way of using this hour is if there are questions that are either burning you up or which you think are of interest or which are puzzling you. I think that's the best way we can use the hour. I don't really want to sort of give in and just sort of trundle through an exercise, but so. Is it all just easy? Are there particular exercises that are difficult? Are there particular sections that are difficult? I mean, that may be a good way of getting going with questions and answers. Are there sections from part one to part four that you've stumbled over, that you're not sure how to get from the beginning of that section to the end of that section or that chapter? Or is it all a bit of a blur? Or are there some that are easy? I mean, that's quite a useful thing. Are there some sections where you just think, oh, that's the section that had made it all clear for me? Nope. Are there sections where even different parts? Part two, part three, part four, which ones of those did you find? I have a notion of which ones are probably the harder ones of those three, but do you agree with me? Which of those three do you think is hard? How would you rank them in terms of which ones are easiest and which ones are hardest in terms of part two, three? I'm judging the part one was just a sort of getting going thing, but part two, three, and four, which of those are easy and hard? Anyone? That fan is annoying. I'm not going to be able to stop it. Say again. Part two. Yeah. Oh, four. Right. That's not what I had guessed. Right. But that's very useful to know, because I suppose the difficulty there is we can't sort of just turn the handle with the maths. So that is back to physics. Would others agree with that? Is that any? That's a fairly quick nodding there. Okay, well that's interesting, because that's not what I would have guessed, but I can see why, because that is in a sense where the maths hits the road. So right, well that's good then. That gives us a place to start. If, by the way, I'll flip back to this page. If any of you are online and want to ask questions there, then I don't entirely anonymously, then we can do that. So. One of these must be there. Oh, just by the way, the videos on the Microsoft Stream from the 2 years ago. Are any of you looking at those? Are they useful at all? I think I sort of seems a rather tentative nod. I'm not going to ask you questions about it. It's just I ask people for information. So that's not.
Is all of the course on there, all the videos?
I think so, yes. I think part. If the lectures for part four aren't there, then they certainly should be. I might not be able to. One second. Come on, I'm painting. Thank you. Journals. Okay, the lecture 11 from last year isn't. I need to. In fact, why don't I just. Because if I don't, then I will forget. This is 2020. Oh, there's such a lot of Zoom, wasn't there? Noted. Okay. That wasn't what we were doing. Oh, yes, that what we were doing was this. So, can we make that bigger? So, let's narrow this down. So the stuff on the angular momentum tensor. And that was all about trying to get our. Explain where the energy momentum potential comes from, and this notion of dust. So, and the point of that, the reason why we're interested in the energy momentum potential is because that's what is the source of the change in the curvature of space-time. That's the right-hand side in Einstein's equation. That's the bit which says matter tells space how to curve. So the geodesics is space tells matter how to move. Einstein's equation is matter tells space how to curve. Matter, it's not matter we're talking about really. It's not matter that tells space how to curve. It's energy momentum that tells space how to curve. Are you a question? No, you're just scratching your elbow. It's energy momentum that tells space how to curve. So the step one there was turning some of our intuitions about matter, which is the most compact form of energy momentum. How do we turn that into a geometrical form? So the goal with that section one is just geometrize the notion of lumps of matter. That's a question.
If energy and momentum tell space how to curve,
yes.
Does that mean that light curves space?
Yes.
But then why do we think that light moves along the curved space? How does that light curve space?
Well, because this is both halves of that. Slogan that energy momentum tells space how to curve, and then test particles within that space are what explore the space and are curved by it. So a star curves the space-time around it, and a planet, a test particle in that, which is a lump of energy momentum, does. Follow geodesic and curve, but at the same time, that planet is curving the space-time around it. So the sort of recursiveness of that slogan is part of the thing to meditate on, in a sense. But it is true that enough light. I mean, if there was enough energy enough light energy in a small space, then it would curve space-time, and that's sort of the Big Bang. So the Big Bang is where there's enough energy in a sufficiently small space that you have the whole universe being curved around it. And another thing is that if you think of gravitational waves, So these are, you know, these oscillatory solutions in space-time. Those themselves are, they have energy momentum in them. So they themselves curve space-time. And that's why Einstein's equations are hard to solve, because they're non-linear. With things like Maxwell's equations. If you take a solution of Maxwell's equations, so light, a light ray, and add another solution of Maxwell's equations, another light ray, then the sum of the two is a solution of Maxwell's equations. In other words, light can pass through, light rays can pass through each other. So you add two light rays together, you also get a solution of Maxwell's equations. That's not true for a nonlinear differential equation like Einstein's equations. So the solutions to Einstein's equations are not additive. You can't add two solutions to Einstein's equations together and get a solution of Einstein's equations. That's why it's hard to solve. So because there's a whole chunk of mathematical methods which is all about decomposing differential equations down to ones you can solve, and the idea that they're additive is part of that. So the recursiveness of that slogan is, in a sense, talking to several different things. It's talking to the idea that it's mass that is both the thing which explores the space-time and the thing which creates the curvature. So the point of that first section is to geometrize the idea of mass, and to remind us, perhaps, that mass is not the only source of energy momentum. It's the most important source of energy momentum in, you know, our near experience, but it's not the only source. And then the second part, and we can come back to which part we can explore a little more in a moment. The next part is the guessing bit. And just to reiterate, it is guesswork. Einstein was inspired by the form of Poisson's equation, which relates the Newtonian gravitational potential to the distribution of matter, and so that, you know, there's a second derivative equals a mass thing, and that's sort of giving a hint. But the form of Einstein's equation is a guess, and the experimental corroboration of general relativity is the experimental corroboration of that guess. And the idea that you might have the cosmological constant in there was there in response to an apparent falsification of that guess. It appeared that the expanding cosmological solution that was found fairly early on was clearly wrong. Therefore, that guess was clearly wrong. Therefore, the cosmological constant was added as in response. But it turned out, no, that's not wrong. It is actually the case that the universe is expanding. Therefore, there's no need to add the cosmological constant. Therefore, the original guess was perfectly good. And still later, it's turned out that with things like quantum gravity or blah, 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 dark energy, it might be that, in fact, there is another case for adding that term in to the equation. So there's still a certain provisionality, a very slight provisionality, but a certain provisionality to the form of Einstein's equations. And the fact of the equivalence principle that says there's no curvature coupling, that says there's no extra things added to special relativity, there's no extra things added to physics because of curvature. There's no term in the general relativistic version of Maxwell's equations, for example, which involves the curvature, local curvature. That's a physical statement which says, no, you won't have to add anything to Einstein's equations to deal with curvature. You won't have to add any other bits of physics to deal with curvature. So part two there is the guess bit. And part three is, okay, so end of 4.2 is basically the end of this course. The GRG1 is getting up to the point where we've declared Einstein's equations. And so 4.3 is just a bonus. Now, it's a bonus that's I can't remember what the objectives say. Perform some dynamical calculations. If you look through the past papers, you'll see that the dynamical calculations in question are things like, can you draw very simple deductions about. I can't remember. There's one that I've asked in the past about the duties equation in our curved space time. That if you start off moving radially, you carry on moving radially, and stuff like that. So that's what I mean by simple dynamical calculations. I mean, if you look back to past papers, I'm not asking you to solve as orbits in Schwarzschild space times. It's very simple things. Because there's simply not much time in a question, and that is what GRG2 is all about in a sense. So part 4.3 there is really just going, illustrating one particular solution, just because I can't resist not doing so. I don't want to leave you with no solutions. So that's how those three things sort of slot together. In terms of the sequence of ideas and the separation between the different ideas, we could dig into. I mean, of those three parts, are the bits that we should be useful to talk more about in detail? Which of the parts of those what good to dig into? Because I think you're right. This is actually from some points of view. The hard bit of the course, because it is actually about trying to use these mathematical tools in practice, and trying to connect them to the physics that you've spent the rest of your degree absorbing. So, nice tools. We finally get to use them. So, which of those sections would be useful to dig into? Do you think? 4.1, 4.2, 4.3. Cases. Or should I just blether on about going through it?
Can you please go over the second objective, but all the section
back? Okay, second. Explaining the Kolmogorov semicolon rule. Okay, that the Kolmogorov semicolon rule is, I think, which section is that? Specifically, the Kolmogorov semicolon rule is. Come on. Yeah. Is this section here on? The equivalence principle. So the Kolmogorov semicolon rule is one of the ways of saying the equivalence principle. So the equivalence principle is in one version of it is the thing that we sort of covered in part one when we talked about the way back in part one and the idea that you can't tell if you're in free fall, you can't tell whether you're way out in space, away from all gravitating matter, or you're in a lift shaft falling to the ground. You can't. They aren't different. It's not that you can't. It's not that you. It's hard to tell the difference. Is you cannot tell the difference. So, as a physical statement, those two things are the same. It's what we said in part one and what we're repeating here. Now, another version of that is a stronger version of that. Is because that's consistent with. Free fall being a sort of special case. It might be that there's all sorts of things that aren't there in free fall when you're in the local inertial frame. Because being in the local inertial frame, you're in free fall, you have the coordinates that are attached to that are nice and simple, and you can do calculations in that frame very easily. So the local inertial frame is clearly somewhat special. But is it only special because for calculational reasons, or is it special otherwise? And the strong equivalence principle is saying, no, it's not special at all, in a way. Any physical law that can be expressed in tensor notation in SR, so a geometrical statement of physical law, this is key to the idea of geometry, has exactly the same form in a locally inertial frame of a curved space-time. And what that means is, do I say, with no extra curvature terms appearing on the right-hand side. In other words, it's not that there is some extra. If that's a that's a conservation law in special relativity, or rather that is with single partial with partial differentiation. The tensor form of that is this. So that's a tensor. The tensor form, the geometrical form of a special relativity conservation law. And the strong equivalence principle says that's true in GR. End of story. It's not that plus some curvature terms, which happen to be zero in the local inertial frame. It's there are no extra terms. So there are no tidal terms. There are no there's no extra energy in the curvature, which is implicit in the curvature. It's just there's nothing else on the right hand side there. Because the basic equivalence principle is consistent with there being other terms there which are simply zero in the local inertial frame. The strong equivalence says no, they're not there at all. And what that is that for Maxwell's equations, which are already basically in a geometrical form, there's no extra terms in Maxwell's equations which are to do with geometry. So light doesn't propagate differently in a curved space-time. It propagates in a there's two ways of saying there's no extra there's no curvature coupling. There's no extra curvature terms, and that is the slogan for that is that the point being made there is that you can go from the special relativistic version, T mu nu, comma, nu equals zero, to the general relativistic version, T mu nu, semicolon, nu equals zero, and that's the lithological law. So that is, this quote, comma goes semicolon rule, is a way of thinking about that physical statement, that there's no extra curvature coupling. Now, and the point of the comma goes semicolon rule is that there's sort of two, only one of which is being referred to here. Because if you remember all the stuff about working in the local inertial frame, the reason why we're working in the local inertial frame is because the calculations are easy. But if we have if in that easy frame we have an equation which involves involves just components or single derivatives of components, not double derivatives, second derivatives, but single derivatives of components, then that is then although we calculated that in the local inertial frame, these special coordinates, that's all the bits that would survive of a more complicated expression which are transformed into these coordinates. In other words, that is equal to the covariant version of that expression. I'm trying to, for example, let's go back to here. I was looking at this earlier. I think we may have talked about this briefly last time. For example, I'll make that a little bigger. That's one of the exercises later on in part three, and it's about calculating this expression here. Does that go on slightly beyond that? Okay. Show that. And the point is that there, we do the calculation in the local inertial frame. The point being that the rest of this expression, this complicated expression here, is all zero because the Christoffel symbols are zero in those coordinates. So in this frame, this potentially very complicated expression turns, you know, collapses to just that. And we can, in these coordinates, we can compare that with the expression like 349 for the Riemann tensor, and discover that that expression there is all the bits of the Riemann of that expression in 349 that survive. In other words, this is equal to this in these coordinates. But this equation here is an equation between components of a tensor, which is true in this frame. In this frame, in these coordinates. But if those components are equal in that frame, then they will be equal in any frame. If you transform the left-hand side from the local inertia frame into something else, and transform the right-hand side from the local inertia frame into something else, then you'll still have an equality there. You'll have a mess of more terms on the right-hand side, but you'll still have an equality. In other words, this is a tensor equation.
And that only works because the subscripts of the nabla are different.
Yes, because this here, that's nabla I, nabla j, vk minus nabla j, nabla I, vk. That's true in principle, but we would what we see here would be a zero here, because I think if you swap I and j, then you change sign, so you end up with I'm not sure what you're meaning.
Shouldn't we also have a gamma k below j, I, comma I?
I'd have to go back and look at the intermediate steps there, but I think that we would end up with this, if that were I, we'd end up with zero on the right-hand side, because again, I have to go back through the intermediate steps, but because that's a commutative. So nabla I v minus nabla I v will be equal to zero. But the point here is that here you have a tensor. So if that's a tensor, if the components of the tensor are equal, then the tensors are equal as geometrical objects. And that's sort of a comma goes semicolon rule, in the sense that you can go from. That's not perhaps a terrifically good expression of it, but is there another version of that which illustrates that better, which I can't. I'm not going to find one immediately, but I'm not going to find one immediately, but the I'm risking overcomplicating this by speaking too much. So the key point I want to stress is that there's two cases where you go from a comma to a semicolon. One is in the general context of this thing about doing calculations in the local inertial frame and then deducing that you've actually got a tensor equation, therefore you can turn the comma into a semicolon, and that's a mathematical trick. And the other is this version, the rephrasing of the equivalence principle, to say that there's no curvature coupling. there's no differential equation such as that conservation equation in special relativity, which will just involve a comma, a single partial derivative, can be turned into a physical law. That physical law in special relativity can be turned into a physical law in general relativity by turning the comma into a semicolon. And that's a physical statement, not a mathematical trick. So the distinction between those two things is the important thing. And so where are we? So that objective is basically, say what I just said. It's in your own words, explain that in a way which indicates that you do actually understand it. Is the goal there? So I think the objectives in part four are not actually terribly hard. I think the ideas, the aims in, this is one of the ones where the aims are quite hard, but the objectives aren't massively hard for what I want to be able to be testable on. I think these two things are both explain things. They're not do a calculation, but show me you understand. Great questions, which are a pest to mark, but I think quite good as ways of, I think they're quite useful objectives in terms of, if you can do this, then I sort of believe you understand it. Which is getting back to the point of exams as a fair rubbish way of going about, of assessing things. It'd be so much simpler if we could just say, there are the aims. Have you achieved the aims? Yeah. Have a degree. That would be simpler. 4.2. Okay, we're going to look at that. So 4.2. Come on. Right. Okay. Deduce 4.8. Give the Hilbert tensors. Right. Okay. I think there actually was one of the. Things mentioned in the thing last week. Where I think I slightly. I can't remember why I didn't talk about that last time. I think whatever. Right. I remember this. Do the Hilbert tensors. What I'm going to do is rather than write it out, I'm going to talk through the notes. 4.2. Okay. Now, it's quite brief, isn't it? As a note, perhaps I should expand that. Perhaps we should write this down to some extent. Just so we've got some place to. So the I think that this ansatz is suggested in the question. So A rho plus B P U cross U plus C rho plus D P G. Equation 4.4, let's go back to this. So for dust, what I've said there is if we are to be consistent with equation 4.4, that's equation 4.4, why is it obvious that we must have A equals 1 and C equals 0? Right. If we are in the moment article moving reference frame, then G is diagonal. What are we choosing? What's is it minus plus plus here? Plus one. Okay. So, if in the case of dust, this expression here is if we are going with this ansatz here, then if that's consistent with this, in the case of dust, dust is remember is the case where the pressure is zero, so it's an ideal fluid, which being made of dust, you know, which is stationary, is not banging against the dust particles, are not banging against each other or banging against the walls of a notional container. There's no pressure, so P in this and that is zero. So that turns into A rho U cross U plus C rho G. And if this is to be the case, if C wasn't zero in this general expression, then we would see a G in this term, which we don't. So this is this general term, the general expression here, has to, if it's to be consistent with that, then the only way that can be is if A is 1 and C is 0. So it can't. So we deduce that term can't be present in the stress, the energy momentum tensor. Dust implies C, so A equals 1, C equals 0. Okay, I can perhaps expand on the note for that a little bit to make it less need a little less unpacking. Now, in the moment article moving reference frame, there U is equal to 1, 0, 0, 0, and G is equal to just that. So there, T 0, 0 is A is rho plus B P U 0 U 0 plus D P G 0 0, which is minus 1, which is rho plus B P, you know, 1 times 1 is 1, minus, where are we, dp. Yep. So, that, oh, okay. Does that make sense? So again, we're picking a frame that where this is simple. So this is the frame in which the dust is not moving. So all these motes of dust are just sitting there, not moving with respect to us, and not moving with respect to each other. Okay. So for each of the motes of dust, the velocity forward vector is nice and simple. Just one, the time component is one, and the is that familiar from your recollection of special relativity? Okay. I'm seeing some nods and some sort of slightly I'll look that up later type nods. And G is nice and simple in this frame. So just plugging these numbers in, we see T00 is that. And Tij will be rho plus bp. The uis are zero, you know, times zero, plus dp, and the metric here is zero off the diagonal, and all of the terms on the diagonal are ones, so that will be one if I and G are equal, and zero otherwise. Say again?
Why are they all the UIs?
Because in the, if you think of the special relativistic four vector for velocity, that is, is equal to dx, mu by d tau, which is, if a particle is staying in one place, then the full velocity is the relativistic velocity. It's the spatial components of it are dx0 by d tau, dx1 by d tau, and so on. But x0, for a displacement, the sort of x, think of the Minkowski diagram, a displacement is going to have, will have a dx and a dt. So if a displacement has no displacement in the spatial direction, then that will be purely time-like, purely parallel to the time axis. So x0 will be dt by d tau, 0, 0, 0, which is equal to 1, 0, 0, 0, because the proper time is the same as the coordinate time in the case where the displacement is purely in the time direction, when the displacement isn't moving. So that's a very potted recollection of what the special relativistic four velocity is. But take my word for it at the moment that velocity is simple in the momentarily moving reference frame, because a particle is then moving only in time. That's another way of thinking about it. So the speed of this particle is just sitting there. The speed of me in this room is I'm moving through time but not through space. So the rate of change of my time coordinate is the same as the proper time. And I'm not moving through space at all in this frame. So plugging those in to this, I recover this and this one. And equation 4.7 is the one which I know we've talked about a bit before about the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid being diagonal, because there's no preferred direction, because there's no shear. So if this expression here is to match that, then this d will have to be 1. So that's 4.7. And what the other thing I said? 4.4. Go back to 4.4. Yes. So that implies that T00 is equal to rho plus BP minus P. But 4.4 in this frame is that T is equal to rho U0, which is equal to rho. So this has to be equal to rho, which implies B is equal to 1. So the logic there is that when we were talking about this bit here, we were asking so this is modelling. This is mathematical modelling. You're asking what mathematical structures can I use to pick up the important features of the, these physical objects. And so the mathematical modelling of dust, what do we have available? We have the momentum of the particles, which is each individual particle has a momentum. It's a momentum four vector. It's a special relativistic. You know, the mass times the m times u the special relativistic four momentum. We have the flux that we worked out, asking how this assembly of particles. So that's the momentum of each individual particle. We also worked out the flux vector, which describes how the assembly of particles is moving, how many particles are there going through a unit area in the spatial directions, in the time directions, and so on. And so those are two things we have to play with. We take a punt. What happens if we multiply, if we take the tensor product of those two vectors, call it this tensor T, because we can construct a second rank tensor from first rank tensors by simply taking the outer product. And we know we have to have a second rank tensor here somewhere, because if you remember, if we look at this box of dust, then as the dust is moving, then it's got dust in it. And as the box is moving, if we are instead in a different frame in which the box is moving, then it'll be length contracted by a factor of gamma, of gamma, yes. So the density of the number density of the things in the box will go up in our frame simply because the box has got smaller. But when those particles are moving past us, you know, all at the same speed because they're dust, they're not moving relative to each other. As they're moving past us, there's another factor of gamma, which is the gamma in gamma mv squared. So the number density goes up by a factor of gamma because of the contraction, and the energy density goes up by a factor of gamma squared because of that times the change in the relativistic momentum of each individual particles. So that gamma squared is, so when you change frame from the frame momentarily moving with the dust to something else, you're getting a gamma squared. That's telling you that's not a Lorentz transformation of a vector. It's telling you that gamma squared is telling you there's a rank 2 tensor somewhere here. So that's hinting you've got to find a rank 2 tensor to play with this here.
Number density goes up when two objects have speed relative to each other. Meaning that if I were able to move at the speed of light, would I see everything be a black hole?
You can't move at the speed of light. And so that's just not a question. If something is moving past you very rapidly, then yes, it becomes smaller. And more compact, and so the space time around it would be the metric would be different because you're moving. In the same way that the length contraction, time dilation, the measurements of things happen differently because you're moving. So that's the metric tensor would be the same, but the coordinates in a different frame would be different. Because everyone's frame is equally valid. That's the relativity in the relativity bit in ideal general relativity. It doesn't matter where you are, who you are, how fast you're moving. Your coordinates are as good as anyone else's. And GR is all about the mathematical consequences of that statement. Your coordinates are perfectly good at everyone else's. So when you move at some very high speed next to a mass, your coordinates are going to be different from my coordinates. The metric will be the same. The metric, the distance element of the space-time you're moving through will be the same as geometrically, but the numbers you get out will be different. And what we learn from special relativity is that if you have a collision of... one of the things that provokes a system of alarm when I'm teaching this in second year is if you have a a collision between two relativistic things. Yeah, you have a lump of a putty and a some sort of ball bearing come in at relativistic speed and hit the putty, and the two, there's an inelastic collision, and the thing goes off afterwards, and you balance relativistic flow momentum, and you work out how much the different components are, and the mass, and blah 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 blah, and there's more mass afterwards than before, there was before, and folk go, what? How can there be more mass afterwards than before? Does that mean there's more gravity? No, it doesn't. I mean, yes, that's it. Once you've in that box, if you like, there's now because this box has now had this other relativistic particle come in, smash into the putty, and go off. There's an awful lot of kinetic energy there, and that adds to the energy momentum in that box. So there's no more gravitating stuff in that box. Not because there's more mass in the box, but because, or rather, there's more mass in one frame, but in another frame, there's not more mass. There's just because in the energy momentum, blah blah blah, etc. I see we're running out of time now. But the point is that it's the energy momentum that is different. Is the source of the mass is why we have a tensor here, a geometrical object, and how we were able to, see. Okay, these are things we have to play with. How do we make tensors out of that? And so that question, that exercise, is saying, okay, stepping back a little bit, if you really were starting this from scratch by saying, what do we have to play with? How could we make a tensor? Then all you have to play with are U, mu cross U, and G. So how do you add those together in a way that's consistent with what you have sort of seen in this case? So, yes, that's our... people are putting on their coats now, so that'd be a quick question.
But why do we need to add on top of the velocity vector here, the metric? Because physical intuition can tell us, well, we necessarily need a tensor because we have this gamma
square factor of the metric. We don't have to. I mean, this isn't telling us we have to. But the point of the exercise is saying, if you start from nothing and say, how would we go about making a tensor from what we've got? Then what do we have? We have U and we have G, and we can put them together in what that seems to be the most generic form, given some constraints. What we otherwise know, the expression here, this has to be consistent with this. What does that do? What does that tell us about the in principle, things, the values of A, B, C, and D in that expression. That's us using our imagination. What does the other part of the argument constrain that imagination to be? And I'd better stop there. Not because you've got somewhere else to go, but because, well, you don't have any other lectures to go to, but you probably have somewhere else to go this evening. I think as of 5 o'clock this Friday is the end of teaching for the semester. It can't come too soon. I hope you'll have a good time over the Christmas break and New Year. And I look forward to, I won't see you next semester, but I will, I think, keep the officers going every couple of weeks. I'll try to remember make an announcement of that in the next semester. But unless I see you at the officers, then have a good time. I'm sure we'll bump into you. Enjoy.